Okay, let's get started. We're doing a deep dive today into, well, something that often feels a bit daunting, doesn't it? UK tax saving tips for the 2025-26 tax year.
It really does. And our source material for this, it comes directly from accountants, focusing specifically on this coming tax year.
Right. So our mission today is pretty clear. We want to pull out the most important nuggets of knowledge, the real practical insights from this document.
Exactly. Think of it as understanding the strategy. It's not just what the rules are, but how you might actually use them.
Use them to keep more of your money legally, based on what these experts are saying. We're going to look at investing, saving, gifting, even protecting your assets, and organizing your tax stuff, plus, of course, the actual REITs.
Yeah, it's easy to get a bit overwhelmed by tax, isn't it? But what this document really highlights is that the government puts incentives in place, specific structures.
Ah, to encourage certain things.
Precisely. To encourage certain financial behaviors.
Yeah.
So understanding these isn't just about, ticking boxes for compliance. It's about aligning what you do financially with tax efficiency.
Okay, right. Let's dive straight into the first big area this source covers, using investments to manage your tax. Now, that sounds almost backwards. Putting money in saves you tax now. How does that work?
Well, what's fascinating really is the government's thinking behind it. They use the tax system to nudge economic activity they think the country needs.
Like startups.
Exactly. A lot of these investment reliefs are designed to get money flowing into, say, startups and smaller companies. They're seen as, engines for growth, solving problems, creating jobs, that sort of thing.
Ah, okay. So the tax break is there to sort of balance out the higher risk you take with those kinds of investments.
Spot on. And the document details a few key schemes linked to this. You've got SEES, that's the Seed Enterprise Investment Scheme, very early stage companies.
Right.
If you invest in those, you could get 50% income tax relief on up to £200,000 investment per year, which is huge.
Wow, 50%.
And there are potential capital gains tax breaks down the line too.
Okay, 50% relief is massive. What's the catch? Why isn't everyone doing this?
Well, the catch is usually the risk. These are really early businesses, aren't they? Many just won't make it.
Fair enough.
So the high tax relief is really there to compensate for that big risk. Then, for slightly more established small companies, there's EIS, the Enterprise Investment Scheme.
Okay, and how's EIS different then?
With EIS, you can invest more up to £1 million a year directly into qualifying companies. And you get a 30% income tax reduction on that investment.
30%, still pretty good.
Yeah. And the capital gains, they're exempt from CGT if you hold the shares for at least 3 years.
So slightly less relief than size, bigger investment limit, maybe slightly less risky companies.
Generally, yes.
Yeah.
That's the idea. And then you've also got VCTs, venture capital trusts.
VCT.
Here you're investing indirectly into small companies through a trust structure. The limit's £200,000 a year. And you get a 30% income tax reduction, like EIS. But the key difference is you have to hold the VCT shares for 5 years to keep that initial tax relief.
5 years.
Right.
The big plus, though, is that any income you get from the VCT and any gains when you sell the shares, they're usually completely free of capital gains tax, no matter how long you held them after that initial 5 years.
Interesting. Okay, so that covers the sort of government push for investing in businesses. What about simpler ways? Maybe something with zero capital risk mentioned in the source.
Yes, premium bonds. Good point. Not really an investment in the usual sense. You don't get interest or dividends.
But they have a tax advantage.
They do. You can put in up to £50,000. Your capital is completely safe. It's government backed. And crucially, any prizes you win are totally tax free.
Including the £1 million jackpot.
Including the 2 monthly £1 million jackpots, yes. Tax free. So it's a simple way to hold cash, maybe keep your emergency funds safe with a chance of winning tax free prizes.
Simple, safe, and potentially rewarding.
Okay.
The source also mentions how investments link to capital gains tax, CGT. The annual exemption, the tax-free bit, is still £3,000 for 2025-26.
Correct. That £3,000 allowance hasn't changed. But here's where it gets really interesting with those investment schemes we just talked about, particularly SEES.
Cool.
The document flags a specific tactic. Say you've made a big capital gain, maybe from selling shares or second property. If you then invest an amount equal to that gain into SEES shares,
Yes.
you can actually get an exemption of up to 50% on the capital gains tax you would have owed on that original gain.
Wow, hang on. So investing in SEES could reduce your income tax and potentially slash a separate CGT bill?
Potentially, yes.
Yep.
is known as cease reinvestment relief, a powerful tool if you have large gains.
That really is a potential double benefit. Now, beyond what you invest in, the document suggests who owns the investment is also key, especially involving a spouse or civil partner.
Yes, this brings up a really important point about planning as a couple. Mm-hmm. If one of you is a higher or additional rate taxpayer paying 40 or 45% income tax, and your spouse or partner pays tax at a lower rate, or maybe doesn't pay tax at all, you should definitely think about transferring income-producing investments like shares or funds into their name.
And the tax saving comes because?
Because the income from those assets is then taxed at their lower rate. Could be 20%, could even be 0% if it's within their personal allowance instead of your 40 or 45%. That can make a big difference to the household's overall tax bill.
Makes sense. And ISs are obviously fundamental here too.
Absolutely. Can't forget the basics.
Yeah.
You can each put 20,000 pounds a year into ISAs, all the income, all the capital growth inside an ISA, completely tax-free. It's foundational, really.
What about property, specifically buy-to-lets? There's a strategy mentioned about joint names and a specific form, Form 17.
Yes, that's right. If you own buy-to-let property jointly with your spouse or civil partner, HMRC normally assumes a 50-point-50 split of the rental income for tax purposes.
Regardless of who actually owns what percentage.
Exactly. Unless you tell them otherwise using Form 17.
And what does Form 17 let you do?
It lets you declare a different split of the rental income, one that reflects your actual beneficial ownership shares. So if you actually own it, say 80-point-20.
You can split the income 80-point-20 for tax.
Yes. And the key insight here is if one partner is a lower earner, you can arrange the ownership and use Form 17 to declare the split so the larger chunk of rental income is taxed at their lower rate. It has to reflect the true ownership, mind.
Okay, a very specific tactic for landlord couples. What about just renting out a spare room in your own house?
Ah, renter room relief. The document mentions that. You can get up to 7,500 pounds of rental income per year, completely tax-free, from renting out a furnished room in your main home.
Simple and effective if you have the space.
Definitely.
And finally, on investments, just quickly, selling your main home.
Private residence relief. Generally, selling the home you live in as your main residence, you don't pay capital gains tax on the profit. Subject to certain conditions, of course, but it's a huge relief for most homeowners.
Okay, so wrapping up this section on investing, it's a real mix, isn't it? High risk, high relief schemes like SICE and EIs, encouraging business investment.
Mm-hmm.
Simple things like ISAs and premium bonds.
Right.
And then clever structuring for couples with investment income or buy-to-lets. It seems these aren't just ways to grow wealth, but direct ways the tax rules allow you to cut your income and capital gains tax bills.
Absolutely. It's about understanding the tax implications of different assets and how you hold them, being deliberate about it.
Right. Moving on to section two, save your tax. The source really flags pensions here. Why are pensions seen as such a powerful tax saver?
Pensions are, well, arguably the most tax-advantaged way for most people to save long-term. When you pay into a registered pension,
yes,
you immediately get basic rate tax relief added by the government.
So if I put in 80 pounds, the government tops it up to 100 pounds in the pension pot.
Exactly that. That basic 20% relief is added automatically. But, and this is key, if you're a higher or additional rate taxpayer,
paying 40% or 45%?
Yes. The tax relief doesn't stop there. You claim the extra relief back through your self-assessment tax return.
Oh, okay.
The document gives a great example. Say you contribute 4,000 pounds after tax, which becomes 5,000 pounds in the pension with the basic relief added. Mm. If you're a 40% taxpayer, claiming that extra relief on your tax return effectively gives you another 1,000 pounds back.
So that 5,000 pounds boost to your pension only actually cost you 3,000 pounds from your net pay.
Precisely. It's incredibly tax efficient.
Okay.
And for 2025-26, the annual allowance, the maximum you can usually contribute and get tax relief on, is still 60,000 pounds. You're quite generous.
It is. The source also brings up contributing to pensions for kids or grandkids.
Yes, that's another angle. Even if they have no earnings themselves.
How does that work?
You can pay in up to 2,880 pounds net per year for each child. With the basic rate tax relief added, that becomes 3,600 pounds gross going into their pension pot.
And that money is locked away.
Locked away until they reach pension age, currently 55, rising to 57. But you're giving them a massive head start, decades of potential tax-free growth, all kickstarted with tax relief.
That's powerful long-term planning. Now, the source also mentions the big change from last year, the lifetime allowance being scrapped.
Yes, that was a major shift. The lifetime allowance, or LTA, which used to cap the total amount you could build up in pensions without facing extra tax charges. Well, it was officially removed from April 6, 2024.
So no limit on the total pot size anymore?
Not in the same way. It's been replaced by two new allowances that focus more on the lump sums you can take out.
Okay, what are they called?
There's the individual lump sum allowance, the LSA. That limits the amount you can take as a tax-free lump sum, usually capped at $268,275 for most people.
Right, the old 25% tax-free cash, basically, up to a limit.
Sort of, yes. And then there's the individual lump sum and death benefit allowance, the LSDBA, which covers certain lump sums paid out on death too. So the focus now is less on the total value inside the pension and more on the tax treatment when money comes out, especially as lump sums.
Okay. The document also mentions you can draw pension benefits from 55 even if you're still working.
Yes, and notes that flexibility. From age 55, you might be able to start taking money from your pension while still working, maybe even still paying into another pension scheme. You can keep contributing up to age 75. It's not a tax tip as such, but highlights the flexibility available.
Got it. Any other quick saving tips mentioned?
Just a couple of quick reminders from the source. If you happen to be a non-taxpayer, make sure your bank or building society isn't deducting tax from your interest. You should receive it gross.
Right. Fill out the R85 form or check online.
Or just make sure they know your status. And secondly, a reminder about child benefit. If you or your partner earns over £60,000, the benefits start getting clawed back through the high-income child benefit charge. And once income hits £80,000, you lose it entirely.
Okay, so summing up the savings section, pensions are really the big one for tax efficiency, aren't they? Significant upfront relief, tax-free growth, and even with the LTA gone, still very attractive long-term.
They really are hard to beat for tax-efficient long-term saving.
Okay, let's move to section three, gift your tax. Now, this title sounds the most intriguing. How on earth can giving money away save you tax?
Ah, yes, it sounds counterintuitive. This whole section is focused squarely on inheritance tax, or IHT. It's all about planning ahead to potentially reduce the value of your estate that could be taxed when you pass away.
Right, reducing the IHT bill later.
Exactly. And one key way mentioned is making regular gifts out of your income.
Regular gifts out of income. What does that mean exactly?
It means if you set up a regular pattern of giving, say, monthly payments to a child for living costs or annual gifts to grandchildren, and you make these gifts from your normal income, not from capital.
Okay.
And crucially, these gifts don't noticeably reduce your own standard of living.
Mm-hmm.
Then those gifts can be immediately exempt from IHT. There's no 7-year clock on them.
Ah, so it's about establishing a pattern and proving you can afford it from income.
Precisely. It's a way to pass on wealth during your lifetime, completely IHT-free, if you meet those specific conditions.
That's a really useful one for ongoing family support. What about one-off lump sum gifts?
The document outlines the main allowances here. Everyone has an annual IHT exemption of £3,000 per tax year.
Mm.
You can give away gifts up to this amount each year, and they are immediately outside your estate for IHT.
£3,000.
And the useful bit is, if you didn't use last year's £3,000 allowance, you can carry it forward for 1 year and use it this year. So you could potentially give away £6,000 IHT-free in one go using this year's and last year's allowance.
Handy if you missed it. What about bigger gifts, though, say 20K or 15K?
For larger gifts to individuals above the annual exemption, the main rule is the 7-year clock.
Mm.
If you make a gift called a potentially exempt transfer, or PET, and you live for 7 years after making it,
then it's IHT-free.
Then it falls completely outside your estate for IHT purposes. If you die within the 7 years, it might be partly or fully taxable, potentially using up some of your nil rate band. So the sooner you make larger gifts, the better the chance they become fully exempt.
7 years is the magic number then. Are there other specific tax-free ways to gift or support people mentioned?
Yes, a few others are highlighted. There's tax-free childcare. This isn't really an IHT thing, but it's government support. You can get up to £500 every 3 months. That's £2,000 a year per child towards approved childcare costs.
And that doubles for disabled children, doesn't it?
Yes, up to £4,000 a year per disabled child. It's a government top-up scheme.
And what about giving to charity?
Gift aid, hugely important. When you donate to a registered charity using gift aid, the charity can claim back the basic rate tax from HMRC on your donation.
Making your donation worth more to them.
Exactly. And if you are a higher or additional rate taxpayer, you can claim back the extra tax relief, the difference between your rate and the basic rate on your tax return. It reduces the actual cost of the donation to you.
Win-win. The document also lists specific IHT breaks for wedding gifts.
That's right. There are special allowances. Anyone can give an IHT-free gift of up to £1,000 to someone getting married or entering a civil partnership.
Per person.
Per person in the couple, yes. And if you're a parent giving to your own child who's getting married, you can give them up to £5,000 IHT-free. Grandparents can give £2,500.
Useful extras. Now, this section also makes some really critical points about wills and inheritance planning, particularly for partners who aren't married.
Yes, this is a really crucial, sometimes difficult area. The source is very clear. If you leave assets to a long-term partner you aren't married to or in a civil partnership with, inheritance tax will be payable on the value of that gift above the nil rate ban threshold, which is currently £325,000.
So unlike gifts between spouses, there's no automatic IHT exemption for unmarried partners.
Absolutely none. It's a stark difference.
So if you want to leave significant assets to your long-term partner IHT free, what's the only way according to this?
The only way for gifts between partners, whether during life or on death via will, to be completely IHT exempt is to actually marry or register a civil partnership. It's purely down to legal status.
That's a massive point for cohabiting couples to understand. And for married couples or civil partners, there's a tax-smart will strategy mentioned.
Yes. A common strategy is to structure your will so that assets up to the value of your available IHT nil rate band, that £325,000 are left tax-free to someone other than your spouse or partner, maybe children or grandchildren.
Using up your own allowance first.
Exactly. Then the rest of your estate can be left to your surviving spouse or civil partner, and that transfer is completely free of IHT because of the spouse exemption.
So you potentially use your nil rate ban and spouse exemption efficiently.
That's the aim, maximizing the value that passes on tax-free overall.
Okay, so summing up Section 3 on gifting. It's really not just about generosity, is it? It's a proactive way to manage potential IHT down the line, using annual allowances, the seven-year rule, regular gifts from income, and being really aware of the massive difference in treatment for married versus unmarried partners. And a well-drafted will is absolutely central to making any of this work.
It really requires planning and understanding these specific IHT rules. Foresight is key.
Right. Let's move to Section 4. Protect your tax. Now, this sounds less about direct saving, maybe more about insurance and wills again. How does this fit with tax management?
Yeah, this section is more about safeguarding your financial position and your assets, often using business structures or specific insurance types, but in ways that can legally reduce taxable profits or provide tax-free payouts. So it manages tax risk or future liabilities. The source highlights how businesses can pay for certain insurances in a tax-efficient way. Relevant life insurance is one example given.
Relevant life insurance, what is that exactly?
It's basically life insurance that an employer pays for to provide a death in service benefit for an employee, often a director in smaller companies. The key tax bit is the premiums paid by the business are usually an allowable expense against profits.
Reducing the company's tax bill.
Yes. And the payout, the lump sum received by the employee's family if they die, is normally paid free of income tax. And usually outside the estate for inheritance tax, too.
Okay, so tax break for the company paying, tax-free payout for the family. What about health insurance?
Group private medical insurance, PMI, is mentioned. Again, if the business pays the premiums for employees, it's typically an allowable business expense. So it's a tax-efficient way for the company to offer that benefit.
Right.
The document also briefly nods to other business protection, like shareholder protection or key man insurance. These help the business survive financially if a key owner or employee dies or gets seriously ill, and often the premiums are tax deductible for the business.
I see wills are mentioned again here, linking back to the gifting section. Feels important.
It absolutely is. It hammers home again how crucial an up-to-date will is. And it makes the specific point that getting married actually invalidates any will you made before that marriage.
Oh, wow. That's a big trap.
It's a surprisingly common one. And as we said in the gifting section, if you don't have a valid will or it's out of date, your assets might not go where you intended, potentially messing up all your IHT planning and causing unnecessary tax issues.
So the will protects your estate from tax problems in a way.
Exactly. It ensures your carefully planned strategies actually happen. The source also links this back to business protection. Things like key man insurance aren't just about cash flow. The payout could be needed to pay potential taxes or buy out a deceased partner's shares according to a plan, making sure the transition is smooth and doesn't trigger unexpected tax problems.
Okay, so let's sum up Section 4. It's maybe less about upfront tax saving like pensions or ISAs, but more about protecting your business, your family, ensuring your wishes are met via a will, often using insurance structures that have tax advantages built in. It's a layer of managing future tax risks.
Precisely. Tax management through mitigating risk and having the right legal structures in place.
Right. That brings us nicely to Section 5. Organize your tax. This feels like the real nuts and bolts, the practical admin side. What are the key takeaways here for 2025-26?
This part focuses on the mechanics, mainly around self-assessment tax returns. One useful tip mentioned is about getting HMRC to collect tax you owe through your payee tax code rather than paying a lump sum.
How does that work?
If you file your online tax return by the earlier deadline of December 30th.
Not the usual January 31st.
No, the earlier one, December 30th. And if the tax you owe is less than £3,000, HMRC might be able to collect it automatically by adjusting your tax code over the following tax year. Spreads the payment out. The deadline for paper returns to potentially use this is even earlier, October 31st.
Okay, so filing early online gives that option for smaller bills. What about payments on account, those big chunks you sometimes have to pay?
Yes, payments on account. These are advanced payments towards your next year's tax bill, usually based on your last year's liability. They're due by January 31st during the tax year and July 31st after it ends.
Right.
Now, if you know your income is going down significantly in the current year compared to last year, maybe you stopped working or profits are lower.
Yeah.
You can apply to HMRC to formally reduce your payments on account. This stops you overpaying tax during the year and then having to claim it back later.
Makes sense. Now, the document includes some really quite direct advice about dealing with HMRC queries, doesn't it? Calls from the tax man.
It does, and this is perhaps one of the most critical bits of practical advice in the whole thing. It basically says, very strongly, talk to your accountant before you respond to any query from HMRC, whether it's a letter, a phone call, or even a visit.
Why so emphatic? Can't you just answer honestly?
Well, you should always be honest, of course. But tax law is incredibly complex. It's easy to misunderstand a question or give an answer that's technically correct but maybe incomplete or phrased wrongly.
And that could cause problems.
It could easily trigger a much deeper investigation, lead to penalties, or even result in you agreeing to pay tax you don't actually owe. And the source uses this brilliant quote, ask your accountant to check calculations before you agree to pay up.
That's a great line. Check calculations before you agree to pay up.
Exactly. HMRC can make mistakes. Their interpretations aren't always right. Your accountant knows the rules inside out. They can spot errors. They can frame your response correctly. Never feel pressured to agree to anything on the spot. Ask for time, ask for it in writing, and get advice.
Crucial advice. And finally, record keeping is mentioned. The boring bit.
Maybe seen as boring, but absolutely fundamental. Keeping complete, accurate, organized records for your business and personal finances makes everything easier. If HMRC does open an inquiry, good records mean you can quickly justify the figures on your tax return, answer questions confidently, and it massively reduces the risk of extra tax or penalties just because you couldn't prove something.
So summing up Section 5 on organization, it's about being proactive. Hit the right deadlines, manage your payments on account if your income changes, and critically, always, always get professional advice before you engage with HMRC on any query. It's defense.
Absolutely. Good admin and expert support are vital parts of tax efficiency, not just compliance.
Okay, that takes us to our final section, Section 6. This is where we look at the actual tax rates for 2025-26 and a specific recommendation the source makes for owner-managed companies. Knowing the rates really frames everything else, doesn't it?
It really does. It shows you the landscape. So let's quickly run through the main income tax rates and bands for 2025-26. As per the document, the personal allowance, the amount you can earn completely tax-free, stays at £12,570.
And the first 500 pounds of dividends is tax-free within that, too.
Yes, there's a separate 500-pound dividend allowance, meaning the first 500 pounds of dividends are taxed at 0%, regardless of your other income. And remember, that £12,570 personal allowance starts getting reduced if your income goes over £100,000.
Right, it tapers away. For every 2 pounds you earn over £100K, you lose 1 pound of the allowance.
Correct, which creates a nasty effective tax rate of around 60% in that specific income band between £100,000 and £125,140.
Ouch. So things like pension contributions become super valuable around that £100K mark.
Hugely valuable. Making a pension contribution to bring your adjusted net income back below £100,000 not only gets you tax relief on the contribution itself, but it also preserves your full personal allowance. Double win.
Okay, So above the personal allowance, what's next?
The basic rate band runs from £12,571 up to £50,270. Income tax in this band is 20%. Dividend income is taxed at 8.75%.
And then the higher rate kicks in.
Yes, from £50,271 up to £125,140. Income tax jumps to 40%. And the dividend tax rate goes up quite sharply, too, to 33.75%.
And the top band.
That's the additional rate for all income over £125,140. Income tax is 45%, and the dividend tax rate is 39.35%. So you see those jumps are significant.
You really are. And that £500 dividend allowance applies across all bands.
Yes. Everyone gets that first £500 of dividends tax-free.
What about capital gains tax rates for 2025-26? We know the annual tax-free amount, the annual exemption, is staying at £3,000.
Or a few thousand pounds. For gains above that, the rate depends on your income tax band. For most assets like shares or funds, if your total income means you're a basic rate taxpayer, CGT is 10%.
And if you're a higher or additional rate taxpayer,
then it's 20% on those types of assets.
But residential property gets taxed higher, doesn't it? If it's not your main home.
Yes, gains on residential property face higher CGT rates. For basic rate taxpayers, it's 18%. For higher or additional rate taxpayers, it's 24%.
That 24% rate on property gains for higher earners, that can be a hefty bill. Okay, finally, the document gives a very specific recommendation for how owners of small limited companies should pay themselves, salary versus dividends.
Yes, it does. Assuming the director has no other personal income sources, the combination recommended in this source material is to take a salary of £12,570.
Exactly, the personal allowance.
Exactly, and then take dividends of £37,700 on top of that. And this applies per director, if there's more than one.
Okay, so why that specific mix? Salary up to the personal allowance.
Well, taking a salary up to the personal allowance is usually tax efficient for a few reasons. Firstly, the salary is a deductible expense for the company, reducing its corporation tax bill. Secondly, £12,570 is typically below the threshold where employees' national insurance becomes payable, but high enough to qualify for state pension credits. And thirdly, it uses up the director's personal allowance, so it's received tax-free by them.
Okay, that makes sense. And the £37,700 in dividends?
That amount, added to the £12,570 salary, takes their total income up to £50,270, which is precisely the top of the basic rate income tax band. So those dividends are taxed at the lower basic dividend rate of 8.75% rather than the higher dividend rates or the basic income tax rate of 20%. It's about finding the sweet spot.
Got it. Optimizing across company tax, personal income tax, and national insurance. So wrapping up Section 6. Understanding these specific rates, income tax, dividend tax, CGT, and the bands they apply in for 2025-26 is absolutely fundamental. It shows the terrain, and it explains why certain strategies like pension contributions near £100K or that specific salary dividend mix are often recommended.
Exactly. The rates provide the context, the why, for engaging with all the planning strategies we've been discussing.
Well, that was a really comprehensive deep dive through this source material, wasn't it? We've covered a lot of ground, practical ideas around investing, saving, gifting, protecting assets, the nuts and bolts of organizing your tax, and finally, getting a grip on the actual rates for 2025-26.
We really have. We've pulled out specific examples, the allowances, the tactics, all directly from this document prepared by accountants. It's packed with useful information aimed at helping you navigate the system.
And of course, we absolutely have to repeat the source's own disclaimer and ours. This has been general information based on their analysis for the 2025-26 tax year. Everyone's situation is different. You really should seek proper professional advice tailored specifically to you before making any big financial decisions.
Couldn't agree more. And perhaps, building on everything we've touched on today, you know, the sheer detail and the strategies available, the importance of hitting the right allowances and understanding the rates, the impact of ongoing changes like the LTA removal, the need for good organization. Maybe it leaves you, the listener, with a final thought to consider. Given all this complexity, but also the real opportunities for tax efficiency we've seen, how often should you really be reviewing your own financial position and tax planning? Is that quick look once a year enough anymore? Or does this constantly shifting landscape, coupled with the potential savings involved, perhaps suggest that a more frequent check-in, maybe quarterly, maybe even more regularly, perhaps with your advisor, is actually warranted these days? Just something to mull over as you manage your own finances.